We're so grateful that you're here, and of course we're very thankful that Dr. Fruchtenbaum has agreed to come once again and to bless us with his instruction. I know from a previous meeting that he told me that I should call him his Hebrewness, but I don't have big enough shoes to do that, so he's doctor to me. Now, one thing I didn't do as well is introduce Kathy Hubbard, who's the one at the book table back there, and she is the doctor's personal secretary and very professional, and just does such a great job. But she's the one selling you the books, and that's a reminder that you need to go back there if you haven't. There's a lot of good resources back there, and you need them. We all need them. So now, Dr. Fruchtenbaum, you can find his credentials on the Aerial.org website. And may I just say that the website is just loaded with all kinds of other good information, a great resource, and we encourage you to use that as well. But our doctor is a scholar. Most importantly, he's a man who loves his Messiah. And he has been ever since he was introduced to him, I think at age 12 or 13. And he's dedicated his life in service to him. And you know that he's the founder and the director of Aerial Ministries. And I'm just reading from their website that Aerial was created to evangelize and disciple Jewish brethren. Aerial means Lion of God, representing the Messiah, Yeshua, as the Lion of Judah. It is also an alternate name for Jerusalem, which is found in Isaiah 29:1. The city of peace, now waiting the Prince of Peace to return, and of course, and to rule and reign from Jerusalem over the entire earth. It was in Jerusalem in 1966 that a burning seed of desire was planted in his heart, so that on December 1st, 1977, in San Antonio, Texas, Aerial Ministries began. Now, the emphasis is on evangelism and discipleship, especially to Jews, but also to us Gentiles. The closing words pointing to their purpose reads, "In these last days, the necessity and future for Jewish missions has never been greater. Yet we cannot accomplish this work ourselves. We need our brothers and sisters in the Lord, us Jews and Gentiles alike, to join with and uphold us in this endeavor. And we pray that the Spirit of God will move on you to unite with us in our vision." Just mention again that at the close of the service, we'll be passing a plate, which is a love offering for Dr. Fruchtenbaum and for Aerial Ministries, and your opportunity to give. And, of course, these funds will go directly to Aerial Ministries. Come instruct us, please, Doctor.
Okay, let's turn back to where we left off in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Getting back now to the last trump, and again, it could not be referring to the seventh trumpet of Revelation, since that book would not have been written at the time of this epistle to the Corinthians. There's about a 20 to 30 year break between the writing by Paul and the last writings of the Apostle John. But Corinth was one of those places he was able to stay a long time, was there for about 3 years, so he had plenty of time to teach the whole counsel of God. And among the teachings would have been the teachings about the seven feasts of Israel in Leviticus chapter 23. And while there are seven altogether in the biblical Jewish calendar, they're separate into two different seasons. First, you have the spring cycle that contains the first four. The first four come close together, all within about 50 days of each other. And these are fulfilled by the program of the first coming. So Passover fulfilled by the death of the Messiah, the Feast of Unleavened Bread fulfilled by the offering of his sinless blood. The Feast of First Fruits is fulfilled by his resurrection, and the Feast of Weeks of Pentecost is fulfilled by the birthday of a new entity, the church, the body of the Messiah. You have about a 4-month break, and then you have the last three that come even closer, all within about 15 days of each other, and these are fulfilled by the prophetic program in the future, which are the Feast of Trumpets, followed by the Day of Atonement, and followed by the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Trumpets is something we're going to be dealing with momentarily. But these last three deal with the rapture, the tribulation, and then the Messianic Kingdom. Now, within this epistle, he's already made several references to these holy seasons. Go back for a moment to chapter 5. And in chapter 5, verses 6 and 7, chapter 5, verses 6 and 7, he deals with the Feast of Passover, fulfilled by Messiah's death. Secondly, in verse 8, he deals with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was fulfilled by the offering of his sinless blood. And then in chapters 11 through 14, he deals with the Feast of Weeks, with the church in the church age. Even early in chapter 15, for example, verses 20 to 23, he deals with the Feast of First Fruits, which are fulfilled by the resurrection of the Messiah. So we should notice he's already been dealing with these various festivities of the Jewish calendar, which was ordained by God in Leviticus chapter 23. So we come to verses 50 through 58, and he deals with the last trump. That is also a continuation dealing with the Jewish festivals. Now, the Feast of Trumpets, if you go to any synagogue to this day, on this occasion, what you will hear is 100 trumpet sounds. And the first 99 sounds are three different lengths. Some are long, some are short, some are staccato. And the first 99 notes go back and forth between short, long, staccato, staccato, long, short, and so on. When you get to trumpet sound number 100, that is the longest sound. It's as long as the blower can hold his breath. And the Hebrew is called the Tekiah Gdolah, the great trump, and also Tekiah Acharonah, that is the last trump. And in Judaism, it symbolizes Israel's resurrection from the dead and getting ready to enter into the Messianic Kingdom. And the point is that the Feast of Trumpets will be fulfilled by the actual rapture. And what Paul does, he picks up the resurrection motif, but he applies it to the members of the body of the Messiah, that they will be resurrected from the dead at the time of the last trump. And so last trump refers specifically to the Feast of Trumpets. Now, by itself, it says nothing about the timing of the rapture vis-a-vis the tribulation. But since the festivities are fulfilled in the same order in which they fall, and the order is the Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles, then if it implies anything, it implies a pre-tribulational rapture. Because before the Day of Atonement comes the Feast of Trumpets. And the Day of Atonement is fulfilled by the tribulation, and more specifically, Israel's national atonement in the tribulation. Before you have the fulfillment of the Feast of Tabernacles, which will be fulfilled by the Messianic Kingdom. So it's not actually trying to deal with the timing of this event, but if it implies anything, it would imply a pre-tribulational rapture, because the Feast of Trumpets precedes the Day of Atonement. And so this is more evidential for pre-tribulation rapture than anything else. Let's move on now to the book of Revelation, chapter 19. Now, what he describes in chapter 19, beginning in verse 11 through the end of the chapter, he describes the second coming and summarizes the events of Armageddon. But the first 10 verses of chapter 19 describe events in heaven before the actual second coming. And one of these events in heaven is in verses 6 through 8. I heard, as it were, the voice of a great multitude, as the voice of many waters, as the voice of mighty thunder, saying, Hallelujah, for the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us rejoice and be exceeding glad. Let us give the glory unto him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife had made herself ready. And was given unto her that she should array herself in fine linen, bright and pure, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Now this describes the marriage ceremony between the Lamb, the Messiah, and the bride, which is the church. And notice that the church is already in heaven before the second coming. And so the homegoing of the bride and the second coming cannot be one and the same event. Furthermore, she didn't just arrive into heaven, because notice she is dressed in pure white linen, which he interprets to represent the righteous acts of the saints. Which means by this point of time, all believers of the body of the Messiah were stood before the Messiah, giving an account of how they served the Lord in since they first believed. And as a result, they've all been duly rewarded. All the wood, hay, stubble has been burned away. All that's now showing on the bride is the righteous acts of the saints. And so not only is the body of the Messiah, the church, already in heaven before the second coming, she's been there long enough to undergo the entire judgment seat of the Messiah. This points out again a difference between the rapture and the second coming. And the rapture had taken place much well before the second coming. Now, what the New Testament portrays in the marriage of the groom and the bride is based upon the Jewish procedure of marriage, a courtship and marriage, which undergoes four specific stages. Now, not all four stages are working with all Jewish communities, but still operative with the Orthodox Jewish community and the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. And the first stage is the stage known as the arrangement, where the father of the groom will make the arrangement with the father of the bride, and he'll pay the bride price. Now, this was often done when the future bride and groom were merely children, and so a long time could transpire between the first and second stage. And so there's always a minimum of 1 year, by the way, always a minimum of a 1 year break. But it would not be unusual for the bride and groom only to meet each other for the first time on the wedding day. Many of you may have seen the show or the movie Fiddler on the Roof. One of the songs that Tevye sings to his wife is the first, Do You Love Me? But one of the sentences reads, The first time I met you was on a wedding day. That was not all that unusual in Jewish societies until about the turn of the 20th century. For example, my grandparents met each other on their wedding day. They must have gotten along. They produced 13 children. but that's when they first met, on their wedding day. And so a number of years transpired between the actual arrangement and the actual wedding day. The second stage is called the fetching of the bride. And at some point, the groom would go to the home of the bride to fetch her to his home. But there's two elements more in that second stage. The one element is, it is not the groom that determines the timing of the fetching of the bride. The fetching of the bride time is determined by the father of the groom. And that's why it was said no one knows about the timing, even the angels in heaven, neither does the Son in his humanity know the timing of the fetching. That is for God the Father to finally set it out. And the second element is that the Father will never send the groom to fetch the bride until the groom has prepared a place for his bride. In ancient times, that was merely adding a room to the family compound. But he had that would be the private chamber of the new bride and groom. And so only when that chamber is fully constructed, then at some point the father will send the groom to fetch the bride. And that's the background to the passage we began with the last hour in John 14, verses 1 through 3. He's now in heaven preparing a place for us. Only when that place is fully prepared, for everyone in the body will have their own little compartment, then the Father will determine the timing of the fetching of the bride, which will be the rapture of the church. So by this time here in chapter 19, the fetching has occurred. Now, the third stage is the wedding ceremony, to which a smaller group will be invited, the relatives and special friends of both the bride and the groom. And that's what's happening in verses 6 to 8. But before the actual ceremony, what happens is that the groom Well, not the groom, but the bride, after the bride has been brought to the home of the groom, she would be conducted to what is called the mikveh, the place of immersion, to undergo ritual immersion for cleansing from ritual uncleanness. Ritual immersion for cleansing of ritual cleansing and so on, in preparation for the wedding ceremony. And that's what the judgment seat of the Messiah will be all about, the cleansing of the bride. It won't be water like it is in Jewish custom, it'll be fire. And again, all fire placed on the wood, hay, stubble will simply be destroyed. Fire applied to gold, silver, precious stone will purify these elements. And so, here in verses 6 to 8, all that is showing is the righteous acts of the saints. All of the negatives have been burned away. Then comes the fourth stage, which is the wedding feast. And that is a distinctive stage. So notice in verse 9, that's when the invitation goes out. And in verse 9, and he said unto me, write, blessed are they that are bidden to the marriage feast, the marriage supper of the Lamb. And the marriage feast is going to be a separate element. It will be the element that will inaugurate the Messianic kingdom. And many people that were not part of the wedding ceremony will be invited to the wedding feast. And that would include the resurrected Old Testament saints. They'll include the resurrected tribulation saints and so on. And these are the ones that are referred to as the friends of the bridegroom. And so in our session, the arrangement was already made in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 to 33, Ephesians 5, 22 to 33. And in that process, the father of the groom paid the price, which was the blood of his son. And so now we are waiting for the second stage to occur for us, which will be the rapture of the church. And so the relationship of Messiah, the groom, and the bride parallels the four stages of the Jewish wedding system. And we have yet to experience those elements, but they will come. Let's go back to our notes. This should be on page 9. What he does now is provide five parables, and the main points of these five parables are the three points on top of the outline, urging watchfulness, readiness, and laboring. Now, in Jewish parabolic teaching, you have either one parable or a series of parables, but then you have the application. And following one of the Jewish elements, there are going to be five specific parables. But the application will be made to the very end, which is the judgment of the Gentiles. So we come to the first parable, which is the parable of the porter, recorded in Mark's account. And this one emphasizes the concept of watchfulness. Now, the contrast between those who are watchful or not watchful is a contrast between believers and unbelievers. But again, it's all in preparation for what he will deal with at the end of chapter 25 of Matthew's account. So notice how often the word watch is used. In verse 13, take ye heed, watch. End of verse 34, watch. In the beginning of verse 35, watch therefore. And in verse 37, and what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. In this first parable, the parable of the porter, is emphasizing the concept of watchfulness. Now the second parable is the parable of the master of the house. And here the emphasis is on readiness. While you're watchful, also be ready. So look at verse 44. Therefore, ye also be ready, for an hour that you think not, the Son of Man will come. And that's the emphasis of the second parable. Now go to your next page, page 10. The third parable is the parable of the faithful servant and the evil servant. And again, the contrast is always between those who believe and those who don't believe. And the emphasis of the third parable is on working. So while we are being watchful, we should also be laboring. And you see that point made in verse 46, blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he comes, shall find so doing. At the end of verse 51, there shall be a weeping and a gnashing of teeth. So again, this is still the contrast between those who believe and those who don't believe. And the third major point in this third parable is the emphasis of laboring while being watchful and ready. And one of the descriptive names of the lake of fire is what you see here. There shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. And now the technical name is simply Lake of Fire, but this is a descriptive name. Years ago, somebody mentioned to me that they would rather not go to heaven, but rather go to hell, because there's no sex in heaven. My response is, there's no sex in hell either. So if you'll be in hell, that's fine. You will not see anybody. While the fires of hell is there for torment, it doesn't provide any light. And everybody will be in total blackness and darkness. So you'll hear your friends weeping for their lost state, gnashing for their pain. So let me give you another option. I gave him the gospel, but he didn't believe anyway. Now we come to the parable of the 10 virgins. Now getting back to those four stages that I mentioned earlier, once the groom begins to move for the second stage, the fetching of the bride, then often the bride would not necessarily be living in the same village or town as he is. So he would go out, and without knowing having public transportation and schedules of those days, the virgins of the town of out of which he lives and where he leaves from to fetch the bride will be assigned to go to the edge of the village, edge of the town, and watch for the groom to return with the bride. And here you have the account of 10 virgins, of which 5 are foolish and 5 are wise. Against a contrast between those who believe and those who don't believe. And over in a place like Psalm 14, the term fool is assigned to those who don't believe. It is the fool who says in his heart, there is no God. And so this follows another element in those four stages. So notice the five of these virgins did not bring any oil with them, whereas the wise virgins took their vessels with their lamps. So those who never didn't take any oil with them are those who were lacking the Holy Spirit, because a common symbol of oil is the Holy Spirit, which they do not have. Whereas the wise ones did bring oil with them. So the groom is now returning with the bride, and those with the oil are those who are saved, but those without the oil are those who are not saved. And the wedding feast is a common symbol, especially in Matthew's gospel, one place is chapter 22, but also here in Matthew 25, verses 1 through 13, it determines which of these virgins will enter the wedding feast, which is fulfilled by the Messianic kingdom. And so what happens is that when the foolish virgins have to go into town to find some oil, the groom comes and he brings the wise virgins into the wedding feast. And when those finally come, they're expelled. So in verse 10, notice, while they went away to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready, because this fourth parable reemphasizes what the first two parables taught, readiness and watchfulness. So here you see in verse 10, the readiness, they that were ready, and the watchfulness is in verse 12. Verily I say unto you, I know you not, watch therefore, for you know not the day nor the hour. And so this parable merely reemphasizes the first and second parable, which is watchfulness and readiness. Also notice, these are not people who were saved but lost their salvation. He points out to them, but I say unto you, I know you not. Then he never knew them. Again, the contrast between those who believe and those who don't believe. And then you have the fifth parable in Matthew 25. Go to your next page, verses 14 through 30. The fifth parable is the parable of the talents. And this reemphasizes the third main point, as in the third parable, the parable of laboring. So he points out what the Lord gave three of his servants, funds that they could use in order to gain even more funds. And two of these servants, who represent believers, do wisely with their funds and come back and it's produced more elements for their Lord. But the foolish one merely buried. He didn't even put in a bank to receive interest. He simply buried it, and it produced nothing but was originally given to him. And notice how he's characterized in verse 26. But his Lord answered and said unto him, you wicked and slothful servant. He's not among the righteous. He's among the wicked. He represents the unbelieving element. So he says in verse 30, cast ye out the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. There shall be the weeping and gnashing of teeth. But notice the very disgusting weeping and gnashing of teeth, but now notice the outer darkness. People that will end up in hell, or more specifically later in the lake of fire, the fire in our world produces both heat and produces light. But the fire of the lake of fire will not produce any light. It'll produce heat for torment, but it'll produce no light. So everybody in that period, in that place, will always be in total blackness and darkness, feeling very much alone. He'll hear the others weeping and gnashing of teeth, but each one there will be very much alone forever and ever. So he's told five parables emphasizing watchfulness, readiness, and laboring. Let's go now to the next segment, the judgment of the Gentiles. And this is where these five parables would apply to. But it doesn't say exactly where this judgment will occur. But turn now to the book of Joel, the second minor prophet, Joel chapter 3. Now, at the end of chapter 2, verses 28 through 32, he describes when the Holy Spirit will be poured out upon the people of Israel, and this is when they all come to faith, when all Israel is saved. And that deals with the national salvation of Israel, which is the prerequisite that must be fulfilled before there can be a second coming and before there can be a messianic kingdom. So chapter 3 continues with verse 1, "For behold, in those days and in that time," which days and what time? The days and times, the end of chapter 2, the time of Israel's national salvation. "When I shall bring back the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem." So now he's going to describe a judgment that's in connection with Israel's final restoration in preparation for the kingdom. "Now I will gather all nations and bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I'll execute judgment upon them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and they have parted my land." And so all the Gentiles who survived the tribulation and survived Armageddon will be brought into the valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, what separates the old city from the Mount of Olives is a long valley called the Valley of Kidron, K-I-D-R-O-N, K-I-D-R-O-N. It begins on the hill, that begins this valley, and the valley itself continues to flow all the way down to the Dead Sea. And so whatever water comes through that veil will ultimately end up in the Dead Sea. But the section of the valley that parallels the east wall of Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives is that section of the Kidron Valley known as the Valley of Jehoshaphat. So that's where this judgment will occur, specifically in that part of the Kidron Valley. So with this background, let's go back to our passage. Now, verse 31, "When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the angels with him, then shall he sit on the throne of his glory." So notice then, this is a judgment that will occur following the second coming. And we know from Daniel chapter 12, verses 11 through 13, Daniel chapter 12, verses 11 through 13, there'll be a 75-day period, which will mark after the end of tribulation and before the establishment of the Messianic kingdom. In that 75-day period, there'll be several events to ready the world for the Messianic kingdom. And one of these events is what's described here, the judgment of the Gentiles. So when he comes back at the second time, he'll come back with the angels. He shall sit on the throne of his glory. At the present time, he's sitting on the throne of God the Father. But when he returns, he'll be sitting on the Davidic throne and be the throne of his glory. And then in verse 32, "I will stand before him, will be gathered all the nations." The Greek word for nations, the Greek word for Gentiles is the same term. So it's not nations per se, because it won't be whole nations going one way or the other, but all the Gentiles. And the Gentiles have a mixture, and the futures they have today, those who believe and those who don't believe. And as he gathers all the Gentiles before him, the verse goes on to say, he shall separate them one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. So one by one, he'll simply separate. You're a sheep, you're a goat. You're a sheep, you're a goat. Having made that separation, he will then deal with the sheep Gentiles first. Then, this is verse 34, then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. So those who are the sheep Gentiles will now get to enter into the Messianic kingdom. And it has been prepared for them from the foundation of the world that Gentiles who become believers will enter the Messianic kingdom. He explains why. And in verse 35, for I was hungry, you gave me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. Naked, you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. So because they had done all these things for him, when he was thirsty, gave him drink. Hungry, he gave him food. Naked, they gave him clothing, and so on. And notice these are classed in verse 37 as all the righteous. And in Matthew's gospel in particular, the contrast between the righteous and the unrighteous. The righteous are those who believe, and the unrighteous are those who don't believe. And these righteous ones, the believing Gentiles of the tribulation, respond, we don't remember seeing you in any of these conditions and doing these good things for you. And then the king will answer in verse 40. The king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you did it unto one of these my brethren, even these least, you did it unto me. And what he will point out to them, you didn't do those things directly for me. You did not see me to be able to do these things, but because you did it on behalf of my brethren, and the brethren here is his brethren after the flesh, meaning the Jewish people, and that this is the remnant that's come to faith as a nation, and because so you were provided food and shelter and clothing and so on when the Jews had to flee from massive persecution and things of that nature. And because you did these things on behalf of my believing brethren, my brethren in the flesh, it's viewed as having done unto me. And so for that reason, you will now enter the Messianic kingdom. You are the ones that will populate the Gentile nations of the kingdom. And furthermore, it'll be you who are going to enjoy the blessings for following the principle of Genesis 12, verse 3. I will bless them that bless you. And this is your blessing. I will bless them that bless you. But then in verse 41, he will turn to the other side, the goats. Then shall he say unto them on the left, depart from me, ye cursed, into the eternal fire, which is prepared for the devil and his angels. The lake of fire was not prepared for humanity initially. It was prepared for the angels that fell when Satan led his revolt against God's authority. And the lake of fire was therefore already created somewhere in the universe, but it remained empty, and the first ones to go in there will be the Antichrist and the false prophet. They'll have the lake all to themselves for the first 1,000 years of its habitation. But now at the end of the tribulation and the start of the kingdom, these are going to be killed, but they will go to hell first. And ultimately, they too will end up in the lake of fire, which will follow the 1,000-year Messianic kingdom. So only two men will be in the lake for 1,000 years. And then the rest of all unbelieving humanity and rebellious angels are going to end up in the lake of fire as well. And he will tell them why. And in verse 42 and 43, You didn't give me the needs. You didn't give me to drink. You didn't give me to eat. You didn't give me any clothing, etc. And they will say in response, a similar thing that the sheep Gentiles did, though negatively, we don't remember seeing you in any of these conditions and failing to fulfill these things for you. And then the answer comes in verse 45. Then shall he answer, saying, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you did it not unto one of these least, you did it not unto me. And because they failed to do these things, they viewed as being failing to fulfill the needs of Messiah's brethren after the flesh. And for that reason, ultimately they will end up being executed and sent to hell at this point of time. So when the kingdom begins, only believers enter the kingdom among both Jews and Gentiles. Once you have children being born, you have the first account of unbelievers in the kingdom. When it starts, no unbelievers actually enter in. And notice the contrast he makes in verse 46. And these shall go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous unto eternal life. And keep in mind, they did not become righteous by doing these good things. It's because they were believers, and therefore they're exercising righteousness, and their exercising of righteousness was the evidence of their faith. And a time like the tribulation, when the Jews are being targeted, they did these things on behalf of the Jewish people, just as in Nazi Europe. There were believers here and there, also unbelievers in that case, who sheltered the Jews as well. But in this case, it will be strictly believers that will help the Jews and strictly unbelievers that will join the Antichrist program of Jewish annihilation. So initially, it's hell, but ultimately, it's the lake of fire, detailed in Revelation chapter 20. And so, with these words, he closed the upper room, the Olivet Discourse, and Luke concludes, and every day he was teaching in the temple, and every night he went out and lodged in the mount that's called Olivet, and all the people came early in the morning to him in the temple to hear him. And so this is the final conclusion of the Olivet Discourse. This is the most detailed account of the last days that he chose to make. But let me conclude by pointing out our blessed hope is not trying to find out who the Antichrist is, not trying to find out who the next category, the next candidate to be the Antichrist, and things of that nature. Our blessed hope is to keep looking towards the sky, waiting for the Messiah to come for his bride. And that is the blessed hope. And that is what we look forward to. Selah. A couple of things by way of announcement. Again, if you like these kinds of Jewish studies, keep in mind we have a special program in upstate New York in the months of July and August. And these brochures are on the literature table. It'll tell you what the different courses are. There'll be four different Messianic teachers during these 8 weeks. And the first 2 weeks is one curriculum, then the third, fourth, and fifth week is another curriculum. And the sixth week is the only course we teach every year, the other course in a five-year cycle, which is the detailed version of the life of the Messiah from a Jewish perspective. And that is a 25-hour course we cover in 1 week, 3 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening. And then we have a concluding two-week program. And then we have also a special Labor Day weekend. So if you'd like to like these kinds of studies, you can see who's teaching what by picking up this brochure. And I live here in San Antonio, so I can testify July and August is a very good time to leave this hothouse and enjoy the beautiful mountains of the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York, which is 40 miles south of Canada. So you're more than welcome to come for 1 week, all 8 weeks, plus the Labor Day weekend. Whatever you have the free time, you're more than welcome. Also remember that we publish this magazine. It comes out 4 times a year, and we don't charge for the magazine. We have about anywhere from 4, 5, 6 studies with each magazine. So if you want to receive it, just pick up the blue brochure, unless you already have one, and it'll give you more introduction about the ministry itself. And then you can look at the coupon page, the different ways you can list as far as ways you can participate with us, such as praying for the salvation of the Jewish people. Secondly, to do like him, to give them the good news of Jesus the Messiah. And the way you can do this is in two ways. First of all, by your own testimony, because when we grew up in the Jewish community, we're not taught any distinction between Christians and Gentiles. We grow up thinking these are synonymous terms. If you're not born a Jew, that makes you a Gentile. That part is accurate, but also led to believe in America that makes you a Christian automatically, and of course that's not correct. And so your testimony will be crucial in showing that there is a distinction. But secondly, we use special Jewish gospel literature. And we produce this here at the home office. You can simply call the office or come by and so on. And we have a packet of booklets or tracts that respond to specific Jewish objections to the Messiahship of Yeshua or Jesus. And you can pick up that packet, and the Lord leads, you can give it out and so on and see what God will do. Over the years, I've met Gentile believers who are somewhat fearful of doing that. And they say they have Jewish neighbors, and they're simply living a Christian life and waiting for the Jews to ask them, what makes you different? And some of them have had the same Jewish neighbors for days or years or decades. The Jewish people never ask them, what makes you different? Now, how we act should be in conformity with what we believe. However, nobody's going to be saved by how we live. It needs to be a clear presentation of the gospel. And then, and that is the way we need to communicate. Now, if you're fearful of doing that, here's what you can do with the literature. Put them inside an envelope and mail it to a Jewish contact without giving your name or address away. If you're afraid they might find out based upon the postmarks, if you live in San Antonio, next time you go past Austin, mail it from Austin. If you're from Austin and you're here in San Antonio, or may live from San Antonio, and go that way. But one way or another, we need to get the gospel to them. And I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood thinking that everybody that's not Jewish was automatically a Christian. I grew up believing Hitler, Mussolini, the Pope, Billy Graham, and the Dallas Cowboys are all Gentiles and all Christians. I threw in the Cowboys because I am a Dallas Cowboy fan. This was a good year for them. But it's viewed as a Gentile game because it would not be Jewish running around a field chasing after a pigskin. but these are the ways you can get the gospel out. And then you can pray for the work of our mysteries. You can make a monetary commitment between you and the Lord. But for any donation you give over this weekend, if you put that donation in the upper left-hand corner, we'll send you a receipt for your income tax records. But as far as getting the magazine, or if you want to receive it as a hard copy, give us your full name and address. We'll need to mail it to you. We also send it out as an email. So if you want it as an email, just your email address will be sufficient. And we'll be happy to keep sending you this Bible study material for as long as you want to receive it. So something that is going to fit what we have covered this weekend. Hopefully we'll see you again, either here, there, or in the air.